It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Glad you could be here as we make space to discuss former President Donald Trump pleading not guilty this week to 34 felony charges issued by Manhattan prosecutors. Call in with your questions, your thoughts, what's come up for you in the meantime. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Andra Gillespie is an associate professor of political science at Emory University in Atlanta. Andra, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Well, set this up for us. How significant is this, a former president being criminally charged?
Well, it's significant because it hasn't happened before. Usually we think about our presidents as kind of fading into the sunset, becoming some type of elder statesperson, doing charity projects. With the exception of Grover Cleveland, we're not used to seeing presidents who lose elections come back and then try to run again for office. And we are also not used to presidents being as bombastic as Donald Trump has been. So Donald Trump didn't go away quietly, and there was a specter of criminal activity around him on a number of reasons. And so for that reason, we expected that there was going to be some type of criminal indictment at some point in his post-presidency. I think that the larger question was it going to be this case first, or was it going to be one of the other cases where there are charges that actually more directly relate to his conduct at the end of his presidency?
We're going to put a pin on that because I want to ask you about that in just a moment. But first, looking at Manhattan, how serious are the charges against Trump?
Of all of the allegations that are being investigated right now against former President Trump, these are probably the least serious. So falsifying business records by itself is a misdemeanor in New York. It's being raised to a felony count in New York because of the allegation that the falsification took place in the commission of another crime. And I think the really interesting kind of and admittedly somewhat tricky legal strategy here is to claim that the commissions of other crimes were campaign finance violations. Alvin Bragg appears to be trying to say that not only is this a violation of federal election law, which would be interesting given his position as a law enforcement officer for the county of New York, and not necessarily somebody who's connected to the federal government, but also he's saying this is a violation of New York state law as well. And so that raises it to a felony. If he were to be convicted and get jail time, he wouldn't get a lot of jail time for relatively speaking, and I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know, especially given the number of counts that we have, how long that would actually extend the sentence if it were to get to that particular point. But, you know, the allegations that are being raised in terms of election interference and possibly insurrection and the documents issues that are raised by the papers that were found at Mar-a-Lago have, if he were to be convicted, carry much stiffer fines and would probably be viewed in the minds of many people as being more serious.
So you mentioned Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg. Do you have insight into what Bragg will argue that the underlying crime was here? Because, I mean, what I'm hearing from you is that violations of campaign finance laws could come into play, but how does that overlap then with federal law? And I know that qualifying this, you're not a lawyer, but I mean, I think there are complications here about what is New York state law versus what is federal law.
In his press conference after the arraignment, D.A. Bragg said that there were both New York and federal campaign finance violations that he was using to bump up the misdemeanor charges to felonies. So I think he's going to do a bit of a both-and approach so that if he does get challenged on the you can't prosecute a federal case angle, that he can then invoke New York state campaign finance laws to say that this was in violation of New York state law, and because it happened in New York and because there was an election going on in New York, that was certainly a part of the federal system, because it's important to realize that we don't have one big national election system. We have 50 different elections that are going on at the same time that are being run individually at the state level. He's going to try to be able to make that case. And so, you know, I expect that Trump's team is going to, you know, make some motions to try to dismiss on those particular grounds, and we'll see whether or not The judge actually takes those seriously, and whether or not he chooses to dismiss any of the charges on those grounds.
Yes. Andra, can you explain the process from here? I mean, he's made his first court appearance. We've heard the specific charges. What happens in coming months, coming weeks? What is the process?
So the next court date is scheduled for December. So right now, what the lawyers are doing on both sides is they're putting the case together. They are sharing information. So it's part of due process. There's a discovery period where everybody is supposed to get all of the evidence together so that they are on an equal playing field, so that there aren't supposed to be any surprises, you know, in court that President Trump's lawyers have seen everything that the district attorney's office is bringing against him, and they have an opportunity to be able to construct a rebuttal. I also expect that they're going to be doing lots of kind of preliminary motions, that will, you know, attempt to try to get this case dismissed offhand between now and then. So, you know, this is a somewhat quiet phase of the trial, but it's a really important phase where both sides are going to be putting their case together,
laying
and
their groundwork
with each other. Yeah, so mm-hmm. so that President Trump gets his due process.
Talking about the indictment of former President Trump, Andra Gillespie is here, associate professor of political science at Emory University. You can join in with your questions and what you've been thinking about your comments. 800-642-1234. Andra, Trump and allies, liberals as well, have called the case politically motivated. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has said it is a weaponization of the American criminal justice system. How valid are these concerns?
Well, that's in and of itself a political statement.
Hmm.
You know, and it's not surprising that people who would be aligned with President Trump either very closely or people who would be aligned with him because he shares the same political party would also make these types of claims, because it hasn't happened before. And also, I think because many people think that if President Trump had a conventional post-presidency when he was riding off into the sunset, they probably wouldn't have tried to pursue these charges against him, and they would have let sleeping dogs lie, if you will. There's the idea that they're doing this specifically to try to prevent him from running for office. And then, you know, President Trump says lots of things, and so he's testing out this idea that he can claim victimhood and, you know, see if he can get away with that and rally support for him. And it's been really effective this in the past week for him to be able to raise money. And even kind of going into this week, he was consolidating support in public opinion surveys around his candidacy. So he, you know, his vote share amongst likely Republican primary voters had actually increased in data that had come out the week before. So from a political strategy, yeah, it perfectly makes sense for him to come out and claim that this is a witch hunt, because that's the type of red meat statement that is going to rally his base, who already, you know, have a certain level of grievance that Donald Trump was able to use to successfully mobilize them in 2016.
And I noticed that over the no mugshot thing, that the campaign used a fake mugshot on T-shirts to fundraise.
I mean, yeah, that was planned. I mean, so, you know, I had heard about that, you know, even before Trump had been arraigned. And so, you know, when we talk about the notion of fake news and spin, right, people create their own spin to generate their own brand, and they knew that this was going to be politically effective for them. So, you know, the question is that when you're generating the meme yourself, you know, is this propaganda? Is this, you know, honest and accurate? I think it's really important for people to know that the pictures that you saw on the newspapers or on websites of Trump sitting in the courtroom are really what happened, not necessarily the pictures that you would see of the, you know, the computer-generated versions of it, or even ones where you have Trump's face over somebody in a striped uniform, right? Like, you know, that's not reflective of reality. That's just reflective of people gaming for a position.
Emory University political scientist Andra Gillespie, our guide to the political ramifications of the former president's indictment and his first day in court this week. Call in with your thoughts, your questions, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. At a news conference outlining the charges brought against former President Donald Trump this week, Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg.
These are felony crimes in New York State, no matter who you are. We cannot and will not normalize serious criminal conduct.
Call in with your questions, your comments about the 34 felonies, the historic arraignment, 800-642-1234. We have Emory University Associate Professor of Political Science, Andra Gillespie, here. Let's bring on a call. Rich in Rhinelander. Rich, hi. What would you like to raise?
Good morning. I just want to note that this crime is in a category of white-collar crime. And my understanding is that white-collar crime is very often and very frequently prosecuted and is considered to be a very serious kind of crime. It's not like a hijacking or a breaking or entering, but it is a form of theft. And I know Trump has said this has never been done before. That's simply silly. New York State, Wisconsin, Illinois, and other places routinely prosecute former governors, governors who become former governors in Illinois and so on and so forth, for stealing from the people. And I just want to make the point that white-collar crime is not some special you-get-out-of-jail-free crime.
And, Rich, what you're saying, it's not an anomaly. Andra, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I totally understand what you're saying, and I think that there's a really important moral point to be made here, because there is an implication in, and I don't think it's intended, but I think we really need to deal with it, in the American body politic, that former presidents are impervious to prosecution, right? If they commit crimes, even if they commit crimes while they're president, right, they don't have blanket immunity for the rest of their lives to not be held accountable for those activities. And so I think it's really important for us to just sort of step back and think about what we're doing, even if we're supporters of the former president, right? The larger question here is, did he do the crime? And the trial is going to bear that out, and he'll get due process for it. And then we could talk about, what the consequences are for it. Nobody is suggesting that he go to jail for 100 years behind this crime if he were to be convicted of it. But I'm a former president, you can't do that to me, is not an excuse, right? Because that would make it above the law. And I think we have to ask what would happen if the tables were turned. So are we saying that George W. Bush could go and shoot somebody and get away with it? Are we saying that Barack Obama could rob a bank? Or are we saying that Bill Clinton could commit arson and we're not supposed to do anything about it because they're former presidents? I don't think so, right? And part of respect for the rule of law and part of the high standard that we hold presidents to, is that they should be modeling good behavior. They shouldn't be modeling criminal activity. And so I think these are at the heart of the allegations. We want to give President Trump the opportunity to have his day in court. And we know that he has the presumption of innocence until being proven guilty. But just the whole idea of you can't do this to me, I'm a former president, that doesn't make any sense. And I think if we were talking to other people in our daily lives, like our kids or our parents, we would not accept that level of argumentation from them. So we shouldn't accept it from President Trump.
Rich, thanks for the call. I want to turn now to these other investigations that are coming up here that are percolating. You had mentioned in Georgia, where you are, Fulton County, looking at whether Trump's efforts to overturn Biden's 2020 election win in that state. There's other, whether Trump broke laws in the Capitol insurrection or the handling of classified documents. What is standing out to you in these other investigations?
You know, I mean, I think a lot of people are a little anxious about the timing of any potential indictments that would come of it. I mean, it is true that this is, you know, unusual in the fact that you have somebody who's actively running for president of the United States at the same time. So any action is going to look politically motivated, even though it isn't. But I also think that, you know, the things that are really interesting that are coming out of that case, particularly the federal case that's being handled by Prosecutor Jack White, are the subpoenas. So Jack White, in the last week or two, has been able to secure a number of judicial victories that are going to require people who hadn't really been particularly forthcoming with their testimony to testify before his grand jury. So, you know, it will be a while before we know what was said in those testimonies. But, you know, it's really interesting now that senior level officials, including Vice President Mike Pence, are going to testify in some way, shape, or form. So we'll see kind of if that produces anything, if it produces anything very quickly. And then in Georgia, you know, the grand jury has been disbanded. They have made their report. And so we're just waiting to see when Fannie Willis announces her decision. And so many people think that it'll happen, you know, sometime within the next month or two. So that's probably the next case that we're going to hear some news about.
Talking with Andra Gillespie, Associate Professor of Political Science at Emory University. You can join the conversation, 800-642-1234. Andra, can you say a little bit more about the timing of these cases? I mean, what if, say, the New York case extends well into the 2024 presidential campaign season? I mean, could Trump's criminal charges influence his candidacy?
Well, it will not preclude him from running for office.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that you know, that's really important. But I think the larger question is, will his base of supporters grow tired of all of the drama, all of the messiness that surrounds being criminally indicted at the same time that you're running for president? So this week it did not. Many people are, you know, sympathetic in the Republican Party to the fact that they view this case as being particularly weak or not serious enough. But especially if other indictments come in more serious cases on issues that were more recent, right? That's also, you know, one of the things that comes up in the Stormy Daniels case, was that this information or the alleged crimes took place before he was president, and the indictment was really interesting because it looks like all the checks happened, and many of the checks at least happened or were written in 2017 after President Trump was in office, and so that might have also partially explained the delay of what was going on in terms of bringing charges. But January 6th and the end of the 2020 election cycle happened 2.5 years ago. And so because of that, right, you need time to put a case together. It's complicated, but 2.5 years really isn't a whole lot of time. So, you know, yes, it's going to complicate things, and I think the bigger question is whether or not people's patience with Trump wears thin and whether or not they see a viable Republican alternative who doesn't just carry the same specter of drama and chaos around him or her in the case of Nikki Haley.
I want to turn to your focus of scholarship for a moment. You teach courses on African-American politics. And how might African-American voters react to this indictment?
Well, African-American voters are, by and large, Democratic voters. So I don't expect that there's going to be anything in this particular case that's going to, you know, all of a sudden change their likely voting behavior in a presidential election. I still expect that about 9 out of 10 African-American voters are going to vote Democratic in the 2024 election. We don't see, even with sort of slight upticks in Republican or Republican support amongst Black voters, the conventional wisdom still holds true, and I don't see the trend line changing significantly between 2020 and 2024. You know, I think that the larger, you know, issue for African-American voters is going to be who turns them out to vote. So do people actually directly ask for them to show up to vote in elections? And I think that there is an interesting question as to whether or not Black Republicans would react and respond to this information differently than their white Republican counterparts. We had a very interesting Senate race here in Georgia in 2022. And one of the, you know, interesting things to look at in survey data with admittedly small sample sizes was the fact that their Republicans of color may not have responded to Herschel Walker in the same way that white Republican voters did. And so, you know, if we collect survey data intentionally and we ask the right questions, we may see differences in terms of behavior, and we may see a different threshold for the amount of drama that voters of color are willing to accept. That being said, like, we know that the types of people who were, you know, in the crowd at Mar-a-Lago on Tuesday after the arraignment, and they included very prominent African-American Republicans. You know, we know that there were certain people who were in the crowd who are always in the crowd and, there to be supportive of President Trump, and those did include people of color who have been long supporters of him.
Andra, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Andra Gillespie, Associate Professor of Political Science at Emory University. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a feature about Short Story Night.
Tons of people are in book clubs these days. Groups of friends get together to talk about a particular autobiography or critique a mystery novel's plotline or drink wine. Perhaps you're someone who wishes they could join a book club but says, how does anyone have time for this? If you are, there's hope. Because a Fox Valley librarian has created a monthly event at a local brewery to help even the busiest people continue to be lifelong readers. WPR's Joe Schultz has more on how Short Story Nights have fostered a sense of community for 5 years.
A room with a small stage in Lion's Tail Brewing in Neenah is packed on a Monday. People from all walks of life filter into the brewery to discuss a different short story every month. A murmur begins to fill the room. Then, librarian Richie Zaporowski takes the stage with a microphone.
Hey, I'm Richie from the Neenah Public Library. Thanks for coming out, everyone. This is our fifth anniversary here. Yes. I'm here for 5 years, so let's give it up for 5 years.
Zaporowski hosts Short Story Nights. It's kind of like a book club, but instead of reading a book each month, the group reads one or sometimes a few short stories. Tonight, they're talking about a pair of short stories that center around second-generation immigrants.
This is a story about the mother trying to assimilate into the American culture in a different way, and the daughter...
Zaborowski had the idea for Short Story Nights shortly after becoming a parent. He had two small children at home and wanted to start a traditional book club, but just didn't have the time to read a whole book. He was too busy.
There's people who may not have time for a traditional book club, so this would be a perfect option for them.
Thus, Short Story Nights were born. During the event, Zaborowski leads a conversation about the book. There's also a trivia portion where attendees answer questions tied to the story's theme. And sometimes attendees even interview the authors of the short story they're discussing.
The Short Story Night really produced a great community. You hear about those third spaces all the time. Where can people get together nowadays? And this, I think, is a great third space for people.
Regular attendees agreed with Zaborowski's sentiments about the community forged discussing literature over adult beverages. A few of those attendees are Doug Middleton, Jill Harmon, and Mark Newman.
Because when I first came, other than this guy here, I didn't know anybody. You know, and I've gotten to know people, you know, the ones that are sort of regulars. It's always fun to sit at a table where I don't know anybody.
People come here from throughout the valley, and it's just a lot of fun seeing them again.
We get to, you know, visit with people, like-minded, you know, they're literary, and you get to talk about concepts, and, you know, I'm not watching college basketball, so it's a nice break.
While they all come for the camaraderie, many admit that Zaborowski's infectious personality is what keeps them coming back. Just ask Harmon.
I'm a big fan of Richie's. He started out almost being a stand-up comic. He'd tell us jokes about his family.
For others, like Pat Rosnick, the back and forth between the audience and Zaborowski is what makes the event fun.
We love to come and give Richie a hard time.
And Zaporowski says the attendees are what keep him energized month in and month out.
I can't say enough about the group. They're just a great group, and they're a lot of fun. And like I said, no one takes it too seriously. We have a great discussion. Everyone listens to each other and where they're coming from, and it's been wonderful.
Aside from the friendships forged, short story nights also give people of all perspectives the opportunity to talk about current events through the lens of literature.
Focusing on contemporary stories really allows us to have a conversation that spans all walks of life, and I think it is a safe space where people can get together and voice their opinions.
Whether young or old, rich or poor, Zaporowski says short story night is an accessible way to enjoy literature and forge friendships. And the adult beverages don't hurt either.
WPR's Joe Schultz brought us that piece on short story nights in Neenah. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We circle around to a pair of mayors now reelected to office this week in Madison and Racine. Call in with questions and comments. 800-642-1234. Democrat Satya Rhodes Conway was elected to her second term as Madison's mayor on Tuesday. Mayor Rhodes Conway, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. It's great to be here.
And Democrat Corey Mason won his second full term as Racine mayor in our state's fifth largest city. Mayor Mason, welcome back.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with you, Mayor Mason. You won re-election with 57% of the vote. What are your goals for the new term?
Yeah, I mean, we really want to continue the work that we're able to do to build up the middle class here in the city of Racine. I think making sure that our community is a place where everyone can thrive and achieve the American dream, regardless of their background or where they're coming from, continues to be a great challenge for us to build up our community. But also just looking forward, you know, we're really hoping that the legislature, in conjunction with the budget that the governor has proposed, will finally loosen up some of the restrictions that they've had on local governments for a long time. And that's really a key element to us being successful moving forward.
We're going to get to that shared revenue piece in a moment here. But is there a particular, you said, you know, raising the middle class, is there a trend right now you're seeing in your city that is most worrisome to you?
Yeah, I mean, for a long time, we've been working hard to sort of rebuild our middle class after the manufacturing decline that we saw decades ago. So we're thrilled that we have lower unemployment than we've had in a generation, which is great progress. We just need to make sure that the jobs that are there are actually family-supporting wages that allow people to work and succeed in the middle class. So that requires some job training work that we've been building on and helping people get into the building trades or get into that high-tech job that's going to pay enough so that they can sustain their family.
Turning to you, Mayor Rhodes Conway, you won re-election with 55% of the vote. What unfinished business are you hoping to address in this next term?
Well, the major issue facing Madison continues to be housing, and particularly affordable housing. So we need to be producing much, much more housing in our community, and particularly producing more options for first-time home ownership. So that's been a major focus for the last 4 years, and it's going to continue to be something that we work very hard on in the next four.
What is holding back affordable housing? What are the conditions that you're seeing that just aren't working for Madison?
Well, there's a number of things that are coming together in a little bit of a perfect storm, but one of the fundamental underlying problems is that for about a decade before I came into office, we were not producing enough housing to keep up with our population growth. So we have a deficit of housing in our community, and our population keeps growing. We need to be producing thousands of housing units every year to keep up with our population growth. So that's really our challenge right now.
Perhaps some of those people may live downtown. You know, the pandemic pushed many businesses toward remote work, and there's been reports about how many downtowns lost, you know, residents, they lost retail. What challenges are facing Madison's downtown?
I actually think Madison's downtown is in an upward trend. Obviously, like many downtowns, we were hit by the pandemic pretty hard, but We have recovered better than most larger city downtowns that I've been in since the pandemic. And we do have a good amount of population that actually lives downtown. I expect we will see more of that over the coming years, which would be great. We are seeing some return to office, but not nearly as much as we once were. It's an opportunity for us to really make downtown a 24-hour experience where people, yes, come to work, but also live and play. And I think that's a great opportunity for Madison.
Corey Mason, how is Racine's downtown faring?
Yeah, we're bouncing back pretty well. I mean, I have to give a credit to the governor's grant program that he had for these bounce back grants. But we've had over 60 new businesses start up since the pandemic abated just in our downtown with some small businesses. And that's been great to see. We're seeing different kinds of businesses and a diversity of business owners come into those spaces. So we're excited about that. And, you know, we really view our downtown right on Lake Michigan as one of our best assets. And we're looking forward to a new hotel that's opening up here later this summer and really bringing life back into the downtown in a way that we really enjoyed before the pandemic. And again, like Madison, we're seeing our downtown in the upswing too. But it's small businesses and tourism that are going to drive a lot of that.
But the trick is, how do you keep those startups, those new businesses thriving for years to come? Because those first years, that's really fledgling. And if federal dollars gave it a boost and that's not there in ensuing years, that can be an issue.
It can. I mean, part of the grant funding that we look at now when we do small businesses isn't just startup, but also what we call second stage small business development, right? So that small business that might have two or three employees who's trying to figure out how to get to a place where they might have 9 or 10 employees, how do we help them make that jump? So you have to support that small business community in each sort of part of their life, not just when they're starting out, but when they're looking to grow too. So it takes a concerted effort, but we believe in our small business sector down here. It's the biggest driver of new jobs that we have is in the small business community. And so we're really invested in making sure that they succeed.
I wonder, Mayor Rhodes-Conway, what policy decisions that Madison could make to make this post-COVID downtown revitalization era more equitable, more inclusive?
Yeah, that's something that we have been working on since the pandemic abated. We have a number of different programs through our Small Business Equity and Recovery Fund. Similar to Racine, we are very grateful for the governor's work with the Main Street Bounce Back Grants. That's allowed us to fill some of our vacant storefronts and support our small businesses. We also have a similar approach to supporting businesses in different phases of their growth. One of the things that I'm really proud of that we've done is the Commercial Ownership Assistance Program, which is targeted to underrepresented business owners, so women, people of color, veterans, LGBTQ folks, and helps them move from a situation where they're renting their space to where they're owning their space. We've been able to support some really fantastic businesses in our community with this, and I'm looking forward to supporting more on that journey to ownership and wealth building that really brings. But it is a real focus of ours, particularly for downtown, to make sure that we're encouraging and supporting underrepresented business owners. We recently approved a new TIF district downtown, which will help us do that. And I'm very excited about the prospects of working downtown with some of our stakeholders, including Downtown Madison, Inc., to really forward that work.
Talking with the mayors of Madison and Racine after voters reelected them this week. Join in calling with your questions for Satya Rhodes-Conway, for Corey Mason, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Madison Mayor Satya Rhodes-Conway is here. Racine Mayor Corey Mason, as we explore the most pressing issues for mayors returning to office in their second full terms, join in by calling with what you want mayors to understand, questions you have for city leaders, 800-642-1234. Mayor Corey Mason, your opponent, Alder Henry Perez, focused on the city's rising crime rate in the campaign. What strategies do you have to reduce crime in Racine?
Yeah, I would say that both of our candidacies were really focused on making sure that there's safe and healthy neighborhoods in Racine. In Racine here, we've been working since last year to establish our violent crime reduction initiative, which is really taking a holistic approach at reducing crime. So it's working with the county and the school district. And in doing so, we've made over 600 arrests and are holding violent criminals accountable. We saw an 18% reduction in gun crime from 2021 to 2022 and still making good progress there. But we're also investing in the things that prevent crime in the first place. So that's really making sure that we're doing interventions with younger people who might be at risk of committing crime and giving them the resources to hopefully intervene before crimes happen. So we're really trying to take a holistic approach on it. But really, much of our ability to provide safe and healthy neighborhoods really depends on the legislature finally unfreezing after 20 plus years, the amount of money they send back to cities like Racine to fund their share of police and public safety and other critical services. That's as big a piece of making sure we have safe communities as any other crime strategy that we might be able to come up with.
Those intervention programs, those crime prevention programs, those take budget lines, is what I'm hearing you say. And so in order to have that, that would have a direct effect on crime in your city.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're still working off budgets that we get less funding now from the state in real dollars than we did 20 years ago. And so it's really hard to run a police department on $2,003, right? I mean, costs go up, healthcare costs go up. Our police and firefighters deserve a raise just like every other employee in the economy does. And so, you know, if people want to be able to do that, there's this great opportunity as the state is sitting on a historically large surplus to actually do their part to fund the police. And so we're really optimistic in the legislative session ahead that there's a deal to be had between what the governor's proposed and what the legislature might be thinking.
Holding here on crime, Mayor Rhodes-Conway, Madison has seen a drop in violent crime in recent years, and that's from both the Madison Police Department and the local health department. Why is crime going down, and what more needs to be done?
I think that we've seen a lot of success with the work that both, again, our police department and our violence prevention unit in public health have been doing. And I really give a lot of credit to staff here. Police department has taken a very strategic and targeted approach to understanding when and where crime is happening and who is involved, and to really be, take an evidence-based approach to reducing particular types of crime. They've been focusing over the last year on shots fired, and shots fired are down 40% in Madison. Obviously, they need to be to zero, so we're going to keep working on that. But it is good progress to see. We've also really invested in our Office of Violence Prevention through public health, which is working with the community. We have a violence prevention coalition to invest in our community and invest in young people. Much like Mayor Mason said, we need to make sure that we are preventing crime before it happens, not just after it happens.
And when you say taking an evidence-based approach, what do you mean by that?
So it depends on the type of crime, but there is a whole, science around how you can use environmental factors to prevent crime, how you can look at the patterns in social networks and prevent retaliations, how you can look at, what are the types of crimes that are occurring in a particular area and take particular interventions, or just how you schedule your patrol. And what your officers are actually just doing when they're out there on the street. And this is, I'm not an expert. Our chief is an expert in this, thank goodness. But there is a whole evidence base around what actually works to reduce crime. And similarly, on the public health side, there's an evidence base around what interventions you can make in a community to invest in people, to build community, and to reduce the chances of folks committing crime in the first place.
Madison Mayor Satya Rhodes-Conway here, Racine Mayor Corey Mason. You can join in on challenges and opportunities facing Wisconsin cities, 800-642-1234. Corey Mason, you've previewed this, but talking about shared revenue, the governor calling for the state to raise how much sales tax is shared with local communities like Racine, and his budget plan would devote 20% of sales taxes to local governments. Republican lawmakers say they're open to raising these payments by a lower amount. What impact would this have on Racine?
Yeah, I mean, it gives us our ability to maintain the funding for the staff that we need. I mean, we're using ARPA dollars and a federal SAFER grant to fund 15, 16 positions in public safety right now. And those grants are great. But when they run out next year, we don't have the resources to maintain those positions unless the state actually starts to increase its share of funding for public safety and local services. I mean, it is absurd to me that, you know, we're now more than a decade into freezing these budgets for municipalities. And so if you're a community like Racine, which is landlocked and doesn't have the ability to grow and add economic opportunities outside your borders, it makes it very hard to sustain a budget. So I think everybody said last year, let's fund the police and let's fund local services. We've got the money to do it. I'm optimistic and hopeful as we're going into an Easter weekend here, that there'll be a sense of renewal around investing in local government that we haven't seen in a generation. And again, I appreciate everything the governor's done to propose what he has so far. My hope is that the Republicans will see the value in funding police and other local services too, and that we can get something here to keep us all safe. But without Wisconsin as a state doing its share of funding local services, it will be very hard to keep communities safe.
Let's go to Mike in Franklin. Mike, hi, go ahead.
Good morning. I was wondering what local governments and businesses and labor are doing to try to do things like have training programs. Businesses say that they don't have the people to do the work, but really what we need to do is we need to have a coordinated program where individuals who could be in positions now get trained. So money needs to come from businesses as well if they're going to get the people that they want.
Mike, thank you. Mayor Rhodes Conway, can you field that?
Yeah, absolutely. And Mike's absolutely right. We do need to be better coordinated in our workforce development efforts. I know that Mayor Mason does a lot of great work around this as well. But here in Madison, we have a number of different programs that we fund in the community to help people, particularly in the trades, be in a position where they can get into a pre-apprenticeship and then an apprenticeship program and get on the pathway to a good family-supporting job. But you're absolutely right. It does take the employers participating in that. And that's something that I do think we could be better coordinated on. Local governments, I think, generally do fund some training programs and work with nonprofits. But it does take everybody sitting down at the table to make sure that the folks who want jobs have the skills that they need in order to get the jobs. And the employers certainly desperately need to be hiring folks right now. So it seems like a good time to get the work done.
Thank you both for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, my
Thank
pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Satya Rhodes Conway and Corey Mason are the Democratic mayors of Madison and Racine, respectively reelected this week. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.